Isaiah 51, 1 and 2, for one more time. Hearken to me, ye that follow after righteousness, ye that seek Yahweh. Look unto the rock whence ye are hewn, and to the hole of the pit whence ye are digged. Look unto Abraham your father, and unto Sarah that bare you, for I called him alone, and blessed him, and increased him. That's just what we have been doing in the last 11 messages, and in this message as well, looking back to Abraham, who bore us, Abraham, our father, who bore us. Looking back to them and their descendants and their lineage and their story, if you will, theirs and their descendant story as it unfolds throughout the entire Bible. Not just in that section known as the Old Testament that so seldom is even referred to or consulted in this day and age, but from the beginning of Genesis 12 on through the rest of the entire Bible. Now, before this, and this will be Basics of Christian Identity, Part 12. However, before actually getting into this message, I do need to make a couple corrections from the previous message. When I was talking about the tabernacle in the last message, I think I used the term temple. And really, it's in reference to the tabernacle as it was, although it certainly probably was much applicable to the temple as well. But it was primarily the in reference to the tabernacle in the wilderness as they had built it and used it and took it along with them through the wilderness. And then also I had mentioned in the Holy of Holies and the Ark of the Covenant, I'd mentioned as one of the three objects, coriander seed. And of course what I was speaking of was manna that the Bible says looks like coriander seed. So I needed to make those corrections or I knew I'd get some mail because of that. And I probably still will before this message reaches them, but hopefully we'll cut some of that off at the pass. In one of the earlier messages of this series, excuse me, I seem to have something in my throat, I informed you of what I have now demonstrated to you in the subsequent messages. That is how the Bible, rather than broadening its scope, as it's so often taught today, instead narrows its focus. The Bible begins by focusing on one racial stream, the Adamic race, and then narrows its focus to just one Shemite lineage, that of Abraham, to just one Abrahamic lineage, that of Jacob Israel, and then finally, as we get into the New Testament, past Matthew 13 and whatever it is, or I don't know why I can't remember that reference, but the one that I've used in the past, once we get past that point, then focusing even on a narrower path, finally to one spiritual Israelite lineage, a remnant from both houses of Israel who have made Yeshua Lord, Savior, King, and Husband. That is the story of the Bible. And how often that is missed. That is the thread of the Bible that weaves itself really from the very beginning with Adam because of where that's then headed all the way through to the very end. Or put another way, the story of the Bible is the story of Yahweh's marriage, divorce, and remarriage to the people of Israel. All other peoples, lineages, and races are considered only as they relate to that story and its unfolding saga. With that being true, and hopefully by now, it's taken 11 messages, hopefully to get it through some people's head, but hopefully by now they can see that that is indeed the fact, that that's the truth of the matter. And with that being true, no one can say that it's unimportant to correctly identify who those people, the Israelites, are today. It seems like when you first introduce this to someone, it's like, who cares? What difference does it make? You know, you've heard those statements, and like as we've mentioned before, and made them yourself as well, I'm sure, as I have. But hopefully, with the route that we've taken, no one can say it's unimportant now to identify who those people are. Now, the vast majority of today's world would likely respond to that by saying, well, Hasn't that already been done? But my response to that response is, when? Where? How? Just because someone would tell you that they're Ted Weiland, or that so-and-so is Ted Weiland, doesn't necessarily make it so. Matter of fact, I may not be Ted Weiland. Now, it's not so important to maybe necessarily figure out that I am, but if you want the proof, I've got the evidence, I'll guarantee you. I've got a birth certificate. I've got a Bible that would probably, or could have a Bible that would possibly say that so-and-so had so-and-so if you're not into birth certificates. Or I have people who can testify who have seen me grown up from the very beginning that can tell you that I'm Ted Weiland, or I can produce my driver's license or whatever else is necessary to prove to you the fact that I am. But who cares about that, right? But that's, if you'll follow with the scenario here, that's the only, not that, but what I talked about previously, that is the only quote-unquote evidence that's ever presented that the Jews today are Israelites. Somebody just said it so. That's it. And I suppose that it wouldn't be such a big deal if the stakes weren't so high. Now, some of the Jews claim that they're Israelites. But come to think of it, you know, just how often have you ever heard a Jew even make that claim? You know, they call themselves Jews and Israelis and sometimes Hebrews. But not very often do you hear a Jew claim to be an Israelite. That's interesting. All of a sudden it hit me. I was going to make a statement and all of a sudden it hit me that wait a minute. I don't know that I've ever heard a Jew make a claim that he's an Israelite. Now, if you were to ask him, he very possibly would, and probably would. But it's that, I mean, they're not the ones that even use the term. Consequently, such a conclusion about the Jews is primarily based on the claims of someone else. If you think about it, mainly preachers. And in this day and age, that alone should make you suspicious. The claim that today's Jews are today's Israelites is primarily the assertion of preachers. But think about it and you tell me. Have those same preachers ever provided anyone with one shred of evidence to back up that claim? No. But we're just supposed to believe them because, well, after all, they went to Bible college. You know, I remember holding a conference a few years back in Lander, Wyoming, and there was a Baptist minister who came to protect Lander. Yeah. And we got into somewhat of a discussion, and I challenged him with that thought. I said, hey, you know, what evidence were you ever provided? What evidence? Biblical, archaeological, or historical, were you ever provided by any of your college professors, your Bible college professors, that the Jews today are Israel? Oh, yeah, I got all kinds of evidence, he said. And I said, listen, if I'm wrong and you've got evidence on this, I'd be more than happy to evaluate it. Please send it to me. When you get home, pull it out. You say you've got it, send it to me. Never heard from the man. You know, obviously he wasn't all that interested in protecting his quote-unquote flock, or he didn't have the evidence to begin with, and I know that's indeed the case. Well, just what, which brings us to the question, just what biblical, archaeological, or historical evidence is there that today's Jews are today's Israelites? Absolutely none. Since instead, today's Jews are the imposters that Yeshua forewarned us of in Revelations 2:9 and 3:9. We've looked at it before, but let me share with you again Revelations 2:9 at this point, where it says, I know thy works and tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich, and I know the blasphemy of them that say they are Jews Remember, that's all that's a claim. Either they are making the claim or somebody else is making the claim. That's all there is. Who claim and say they are Jews or Judahites, thus a portion of the Israelites, and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Hard to believe? You don't want to believe me? Well, you don't have to. But maybe you'll believe the Jewish authorities themselves, who confess that they are not Israelites, neither from the house of Israel nor from the house of Judah. Now, I could spend the remainder of the hour quoting Jewish authority after Jewish authority in proving that claim. However, we have far too much to cover in this final message of the series to do that. And anyone truly interested in seeing all the evidence, because at least as much as I could come up with and glean is found there, can read it for themselves in the fourth chapter of God's Covenant People. And by the way, I'm going to mention that a few different times because I don't have the time to go into great detail in all of these areas and share all the information, or we'd be having another three or four messages to this series, which I don't want to do. But I'm not trying, in mentioning the book, I'm not trying to sell the book. In fact, if somebody out there would desperately like to have the book and cannot afford it, I'll send it to you free of charge. Nonetheless, for those to whom maybe all of this is new that will be hearing these tapes at some point in time, let me provide just a few quotations to whet, hopefully, their investigative appetites. My favorite Jewish quote in this regard, and many of these quotes I know most of you have already heard, but for the sake of those who haven't, if you'll bear with me again. But my favorite Jewish quotation out of probably all of them in this regard, simply because it's the most concise and because of how it's introduced, is the one from the 1980 Jewish Almanac. And matter of fact, if you're going to, it's really a great sentence to memorize, to get people to think in this particular area. But again, not just because it's concise, but also because of how it's introduced. It's the very first sentence of the very first chapter of the 1980 Jewish Almanac, a chapter that's entitled Identity Crisis. Now, they understand, we may not understand there's an identity crisis. Most of our people don't understand it. I mean, but they obviously understood there's an identity crisis going on here, because they entitled the very first chapter of the 1980 Jewish Almanac, The Identity Crisis. And here's the very first sentence that follows the title. Quote, strictly speaking, it is incorrect to call an ancient Israelite a Jew, or to call a contemporary Jew an Israelite. Again, and for the sake of those who have never heard that before, let me quote it to you again. It says, strictly speaking, it is incorrect to call an ancient Israelite a Jew or to call a contemporary Jew an Israelite. And yet everybody's doing that, aren't they? Nearly everybody. And so they say, that's why there's an identity crisis. Somebody doesn't know who's who, or they don't know who's not who when it really comes down to it. Still too hard to believe? Well, then consider this, that statement is both demonstrated and documented to be true in all four major Jewish encyclopedias as well. Somebody say, oh, that 1980 Jewish almanac, that's just a fluke. No. By the way, you can't hardly find those babies. I think because of that first sentence and how we've been able to use it, I think they have destroyed them. It took me 3 or 4 years. I've come up with only two in several years of having book searchers all over America try to locate them for me. If you get them, I think they're worth getting. I had to pay $35 per book for them. But I think they've been worth the get, because I think there's very few left in existence. But it's no fluke, because that is backed up, demonstrated, and documented as true in all four major Jewish encyclopedias, the 1905 or 04, depending on the volume, Jewish Encyclopedia, the 1942 Universal Jewish Encyclopedia, the 1971 Encyclopedia Judaica, and the 1977 New Standard Jewish Encyclopedia. All four of them demonstrate and document that statement in the 1980 Jewish Almanac as being true. Arthur Kessler, for example, in a book published by Random House in 1976, and which was on the bestsellers list, not in the Bible bookstores where it should have been, but in the secular bookstores for several weeks, wrote a book, Arthur Koestler, which was published, called The 13th Tribe. On page 17, he writes this, and this is just a small portion. It's a 250-page book, but a small portion of it. On page 17, it says, quote, genetically, they, speaking of today's Jews, are more closely related to the Hun, Ugar, and Magar tribes than to the seed of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Well, that alone ought to. And he even follows that statement up with, and so what is that, or something like this? So what is that going to say about anti-Semitism? And that should wake some people up. That's at the first of the book. At the end of the book, he says this, in this last chapter, I have tried to show that the evidence from anthropology concurs with history in refuting the popular belief in a Jewish race descended from a biblical tribe. That is, the tribe of Judah or any other Israelite tribe. Going a little bit later, he says, the lingering influence of Judaism's racial and historical message, that is, that today's Jews are descended from Israel, though based on an illusion, acts as a powerful emotional break by appealing to tribal loyalty. And then he later says, Abraham Poliak, a professor of history at Tel Aviv University, and no doubt an Israeli patriot, made a major contribution to our knowledge of Jewry's Khazar ancestry, undermining the legend of a chosen race. End of that quote, at least as found in the Jews. Now, the last Jewish quotation I'll use regarding the fact that today's Jews are not Israelites comes from Jack Bernstein. And I'm using it since Mr. Bernstein himself tied or identified today's Jewish people, and this is a Jew who's doing this, don't forget, but tied today's Jewish people with the imposters of Revelation 3 and verse 9. He wrote a book entitled The Life of an American Jew in Racist Marxist Israel. And he was one of the many Jews who in 1942 or shortly thereafter made a migration back to Palestine to establish this Israeli state. Well, he was in for an awakening. Here's part of what he said at the end of the book in a challenge to his other Jewish brethren. Part of it reads as this. The American people have been led to believe that Jews are God's chosen people. This myth was started by a small group of Jews. A few Jewish leaders took excerpts from the Bible and interpreted them to mean that God designated them as chosen people. A little bit later, leading the cry, we are God's chosen people, are the Zionist, Marxist, Ashkenazi Jews who for political purposes chose Judaism and who do not have a drop of biblical Jewish or Judahite or Israelite blood in them. He says, not a drop. Going on a little bit later, the Judeo-Christian ethic we hear so much about in America is a big joke, the result of an intense Zionist propaganda campaign. I'll toss in one last thought about the God's chosen people myth. God said, and then he quotes Revelation 3:9, quote within a quote, beware of those who call themselves Jews and are not, for they lie. End of that quote within a quote, Revelation 3:9. Could it be the Ashkenazi Jews are the people to whom God was referring? End of that quote. The Jewish claim to be in Israel reminds me so much, and I've shared this previously, and you guys have to put up with some redundancy from time to time and more often than not, but it reminds me of the story of the farmer who tossed a coin toward a blind man's cup, and it missed the cup and started rolling toward the gutter. And the blind man, or the man with the cup, immediately jumped up and retrieved the coin. And the farmer looked at him and says, hey, I thought you were blind. To which the man with the cup and the dark glasses said, he says, oh no, I'm just filling in. The real blind man is off at the movies and I'm taking his place. Reminds me a lot of Israel. One of the identifying marks of who Israel is today is that Israel is blind. For the most part, she's blind because her eyes are starting to open up. She's blind to her identity. And until she wakes up to her Israel identity. Let me tell you, we will continue to have the Jews today filling in as the blind man or as blind Israel, when in fact, the Jews see much better than do true Israel. Demonstrated by their own admissions that they are not true Israel. Now, in most cases, there are a few exceptions, but in most cases, keep in mind that those, the Jewish almanac, the different Jewish encyclopedias, are not meant for non-Jewish eyes. That's just, they just meant it for themselves to understand and take care of business. But it's getting out, isn't it? And it can't help but get out. Because sooner or later, blind Israel has to awaken, her eyes have to open, if she's going to return, as God promised she will, to her God, King, and husband. Well, if today's Jews are not Israel, then who are they? If they're not Israel, they've got to be somebody else. Who are they? Mr. Kessler identified them as being Khazars. Mr. Bernstein associated them with the Ashkenazim, essentially two different designations for the same people. Briefly, 95%+ of the people known as Jews today are descendants of the fierce Turkish, Mongolian, Khazar, / Ashkenazim, whichever you prefer, tribes who roamed the steppes of Russia and who adopted the religion, now listen to me, who adopted the religion of Judaism between the 7th and 9th centuries A.D., and thus today's Khazars, because that's what they are, or Ashkenazim, are known as quote-unquote Jews, not because of race, not because they have any lineage link back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but rather because of religion. They're called Jews because they adopted the religion of Judaism. Now, again, that is established in the, I don't know if that particular point is established in the almanac, but it's established in every one of the Jewish encyclopedias, and many authorities on that issue have verified the same thing. Now, there is actually something even more pertinent about who today's Jews are than even that. However, I want to save that for the end of the message, so stay tuned and we'll get to that point of it. Suffice it to say, though, that today's Jews are not Israelites. Thus, someone else must be, since the sun still rules by day. It's out there now, isn't it? And the moon still rules by night. Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 31 through 37. Or God is a liar. If the Jews are not Israel, then someone else must be. So, since someone today must be Israel, who fits the bill? Who satisfies the marks of Israel as provided to us in the Bible? Well, once again, we simply do not have time to go through every biblical mark of Israel in this message. But I will tell you that whereas the Jews are hard-pressed to find one mark, one biblical mark that fits them, there is another people who fit every single one of the biblical marks of Israel in the Bible. They fit every single one of them. For example, there is a people today who are made up of a multitude of nations, Genesis chapter 17, 4 and 6, who became a great nation, and more times than just once, Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3, with a new home, 2 Samuel 7 and verse 10, and a new religion, Jeremiah 31, 7, 31 through 37, who have blessed the rest of the world, Genesis 22 and verse 18, most specifically with the gospel of Yahshua the Christ, and who wear a new name, Isaiah 65 and verse 15. Just a small handful of the spiritual, national, and geographical characteristics of Israel, out of multitudes in the Bible, that are all fulfilled by the Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian, Celtic, and kindred peoples. All of them fulfilled by those people. Whereas the Jews are hard-pressed to find any that might fit them, Those people fit them all. Now, that only scratches what I just provided to you. We didn't even look at the passages. You can do that on your own if you haven't in the past. But that only scratches the scratch on the surface. So if anyone, once again, is interested in a more exhaustive testimonial proving the same, two-thirds of God's covenant people is devoted to the biblical attributes of Israel and who they're found fulfilled in today. Followed by archaeological and historical evidences that prove the same thing. However, it really isn't necessary to go to all that trouble except to further corroborate what's already true. But it's really not that necessary to go all that trouble to prove who Israel is today, since there is one mark alone that undeniably demonstrates who Israel has to be today. It's what, in light of the rest of this series, might be called the mark of marriage. Or today, under the new covenant, we might call it the mark of remarriage. Remember, it was Israel that Yahweh had called into an old covenant marital relationship. That's precisely what the old covenant was it not? I think we've demonstrated that old covenant relationship that began in Exodus chapter 19 was not just an old covenant relationship, but an old covenant marital relationship. And it was also with Israel, remember, or at least a remnant of Israel, with whom Yahweh promised to reunite in a new covenant marital relationship. In that sense, the new covenants, and maybe and only in that sense, other than the law is found in both, but applied in different ways. But in that sense, the new covenant is no different than the old covenant in that they are both marital contracts between Yahweh and Israel. That's what and hopefully that gives us a whole new perspective on the covenants that God made with Israel. And that is why the new covenant was made, not with the whole world. And that's news to people, but that's right. The new covenant was not made with the whole world, nor with anyone of any nation or race of people who would come to Christ, but instead with Israelites from the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Turn with me to Romans to begin with, to Romans chapter 9. Romans chapter 9, beginning with verse 1. I say, of course, Paul is the one who's saying it or writing this. He says, I say the truth in Christ, I lie not, my conscience also bearing me witness in the Holy Ghost, that I have great heaviness and continual sorrow in my heart, for I could wish that I myself were accursed from the Christ for my brethren, my kinsmen, according to the flesh. No way to spiritualize this. Even the New International Version left in the phrase according to the flesh this time. Again, verse 3, for I could wish that I myself were accursed from the Christ for my brethren, my kinsmen, according to the flesh, who are Israelites, to whom pertaineth the adoption and the glory and the covenants and the giving of the law and the service of God and the promises. Verse 4 again, he again says, who are Israelites, to whom pertaineth, or the New American Standard says, to whom belongs the adoption and the glory. And then it says, and the covenants. The covenants, all of them belong to Israel. Why? Why would they only belong to Israel? Well, because they are essentially covenants of matrimony. And thus, those covenants, both old and new alike, belong only to those who were wed to Yahweh or who are being re-wed to Yahweh, that is Israel. Does that make sense? Why would the new covenant? Again, Romans 9:4 is the first witness for us that establishes that the covenants belong to Israel. They don't belong to the rest of the world, as so often is the perception of most Christians today in the world. Most of us, at some point in the past, I'm sure, if not all of us, the covenants don't belong. That's not what the Bible says. There's nowhere that ever says that the covenants belong to anybody other than Israel. Why? Because they're contracts of matrimony, and they can only belong to the wife. Second witness, Hebrews chapter 8. Familiar passage to most of us, but again for those who may not be familiar with it. Hebrews chapter 8, and beginning with verse 7, it says, "For if that first covenant had been faultless, then should no place have been sought for the second." Verse 8, "For finding fault with them, he saith, behold, the days come, saith Yahweh." Now this is quoting from Jeremiah, so it's from Jeremiah's perspective. It's not from this point forward that the days are to come. This is already happening. This is the fulfillment of what Jeremiah wrote about. "For finding fault with them, he saith, behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, when I will make a new covenant with who?" Now, if I was to read that and they weren't familiar with it and ask that question, you can just imagine what kind of answers you'd get from the pulpits or from the congregations of anyone asking that question who were unfamiliar with that answer. They'd do as I did, I'm sure. Well, it was made with anyone who would come to Christ of any race of people. But that's not what it says, does it? Again, verse 8, "For finding fault with them, he saith, behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, because they continued not in my covenant, and I regarded them not, saith the Lord." Consequently, well, first of all, again, first and second witnesses, Romans chapter 9 and Hebrews chapter 8, provide us two witnesses that the covenants belong to Israel. And specifically, where we're headed is that this new marital covenant, belongs only to Israel. Consequently, if you want to locate true Israel today, think about it. You only need to look for the people who for over the last 2,000 years have most readily and predominantly said, "I do," or "I will," to Yahweh's new covenant proposal of marriage. Again, when we sang the song earlier this morning, "Just As I Am," you know, as if it would be a response to the call of salvation from our God. And that's what it is. But hopefully, as a result of this series, we can see that it's much, much more than that. It's just not a call to salvation, a call to have our sins forgiven, a call to go to heaven or wherever it is we'll abide for eternity. But it's a call of Yahweh asking His people once again to be married to Him. And so all you have to do, since it was made with Israel, all you have to do is look for the people over the last 2,000 years who have most readily said, "I do, I will," to that new covenant marriage proposal. Listen to me. History doesn't lie. Now note, I didn't say that history books don't lie. There's a lot of history that's been rewritten in the history books. But history doesn't lie, and everyone knows that the new covenant, or what's known today as Christianity, is the religion of the West. We talk about the Eastern religions, and when we talk about those, we never talk about Christianity. Everybody understands, it's a foregone conclusion, that that's something other than Christianity. Christianity, the new covenant, is the religion of the West, of the Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian, Celtic, and kindred peoples. As I've said and others have said, just take a globe and circle the land masses that are predominantly Christian, and you know who you'll find that have followed that religion and have said, "I do," predominantly, more than anybody else, to the gospel call of Christ or the marriage proposal of Yahweh. Thus, identifying unquestionably, undeniably, identifying those people as being Israel. In fact, the rest of mankind, the rest of the world, wouldn't even know of this religion if it hadn't been for the missionary efforts of these same people, which, by the way, is another identifying Israelite trait. Israel was to be the people who would carry the gospel to the rest of the world. Or really vice versa to that. The rest of the world would come to Israel when Yahweh blessed Israel for her obedience to him and his laws. They'd see the results. They'd see the blessings that he promised in Deuteronomy 28 and the comparable Leviticus chapter. And they'd say, oh, that's what it means to follow Yahweh. You don't have to send missionaries to him, because if you send missionaries to him and you don't have the fruit of the blessings of being in obedience as a nation to Yahweh, they say, why should we serve your God? But when you're serving him and you are his people and his bride and he's blessing you with all the benefits of that marriage, then the other people say, ah, that's what it means to serve Yahweh. And they come to the feet of Israel to learn, as it describes in the Old Testament. Now, that alone, I mean, everything else that I go through in two-thirds of God's covenant people is really nothing but corroboration for the fact that that one thing alone identifies who Israel is. Israel are the people who are the people most prone, most predominantly, and most readily saying, I do or I will to the new covenant proposal of marriage. But since some people are much more prone probably to believe something that the Jews say than they are to believe something from somebody like myself, let me quickly provide you with some Jewish testimony on the same thing. Testimony not only from the Jews that the Jews are not Israel, but Jewish testimony that the Celto-Saxon peoples are Israel, for those who would rather believe them than possibly myself. For example, and I'm just going to share a few again, Dr. Alfred M. Lilienthal in 1953 wrote a book called What Price Israel? And in that book, he made an astounding declaration. He said this, quote, or he wrote this, here's a paradox, a most ingenious paradox, an anthropological fact. Many, speaking of the Celto-Saxon peoples, as I call them, many Celto-Saxon, in brackets, Christians, may have much more Hebrew Israelite blood in their veins than most of their Jewish neighbors. End of that quote. Harry Golden, on April 20th in 1967, printed in the Heritage Southwest Jewish Press, stated this, quote, Isaiah the prophet wrote that the remnant of Yahweh's people would be found in the isles of the sea. Isn't it reasonable this remnant of Israel, of course, may be the people, Celto-Saxon people, of the British Isles? He then went on to say later, as they, speaking of the ten tribes, made their way across Europe, they left indelible evidence of their journey. And then later he says, these, speaking of these Israelites, were the fellows who immigrated to the next island and came to call themselves Scotsmen. End of that quote. Testified, for those who may not know, by the Scottish Declaration of Independence in 1497, I think it was, that traced their lineage back to the Israelites of old. New York Mayor Koch, even, on March 30th, 1987, as reported in the U.S. News and World Report, stated this under a caption, a picture of him and Cardinal O'Connor on St. Patrick's Day in a parade. It stated this, that New York Mayor Ed Koch had stated that, quote, the ten lost tribes of Israel, we, speaking of him and his Jewish buddies, believe ended up in Ireland. End of that quote. And then in 1994, Yair Davidi wrote a book called The Tribes, same year that my book came out, but this time written, this book written by a Jew, actually an Israeli Jew, from over in the land of Palestine. He wrote this, and this is again just part of a larger book, but here's part of what he said. He said, quote, most of the ancient Israelites assimilated to foreign cultures and forgot their origins. That's basically what I've shared throughout this message, this series. He went on, in the course of time, they reached the British Isles in Northwest Europe, whence related nations such as the USA were founded. A little bit later, or later in the book, he said, most of the ancient Israelites were exiled, and listen to this, were exiled and lost their identity, which I've also tried to establish in this series. And then later he said there, speaking of the Celto-Saxon, he says their descendants are to be found mainly amongst, listen to this, mainly amongst the Gentile peoples. of North America, Northwest Europe, Australasia, or obviously Australia, and South Africa. And then later he said, these claims are not far-fetched. And I know to some people, because they've always been taught something else, it seems far-fetched. But if you've always been lied to, the truth is going to sound far-fetched. But this man was honest enough to say, these claims are not far-fetched. They are supported by biblical, historical, and other evidence, much of which is in effect even recognized by the Adamic world. The academic world, which simply has not sufficiently correlated the information in its possession and not drawn the necessary conclusions from the proof it already acknowledges. End of that quote of Yair Davidi. Now let me tell you something. Whether the history books admit it or not, it is an undeniable fact that Israel is today found in the Celto-Saxon peoples of the world. In the people whom the impostors, the Jews masquerading as Israel, hate the most. The people with whom the Jews seem to have a perpetual hatred by their own testimony. Here's one. James Yaffe, 1968, a Jew who wrote the book called The American Jews, centering in on specifically the Germans, and there's a reason for that I don't have time to go into, but centering in specifically on the German people, but representative of all Celto-Saxon peoples, stated this. He said, you can almost see he's trying to understand why this is, and it's quite a confession. He says, quote, at one point, it's almost as if some symbiotic relationship. You know what symbiotic means? It's like the tick fly on the elephant. The elephant allows him to exist on his back, and that relationship, because they benefit each other to some degree. Whether there's a benefit is yet to be seen, but he calls it a symbiotic relationship. Quote, it's almost as if some symbiotic relationship now exists between the Jews and the Germans, and thus all other Celto-Saxons. And he goes on, we can never break loose from them. We're, the Jews, are doomed to go through the ages together, tied to them, that is, the Germans and the other Celto-Saxons, by our Jewish, that is, hatred. Tied to them by their Jewish hatred. End of that quote. A perpetual hatred. Could this be a mark that can help us to further identify today's Jews and who they are? Well, let me ask you this. Why was it that Haman in the book of Esther hated Mordecai? There's no reason whatsoever ever given why Haman in the book of Esther hated Mordecai and his fellow Israelites like he did. Why was it that he did that? Well, let me ask you this. What was Haman's lineage? Can anybody tell me? He was an Agagite, Amalekite, Edomite. An Edomite who had a genetic imprint that caused him to hate all Israelites. You gotta be kidding. I can hear it. No, I'm not. Genesis 25 records that Rebekah bore Isaac twins, Esau the elder, and Jacob the younger. And if you recall, while still in the womb, the two baby boys, quote-unquote, struggled together within her, end of quote. Yahweh explained, as she couldn't understand what was going on inside her, there was something unusual taking place in this pregnancy. And as she inquired of Yahweh, Yahweh explained this rivalry to Rebekah in the following terms in Genesis 25 and verse 23. Where it says, two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels, and the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. Soon after the two boys had been grown, the promise began to find its fulfillment. Genesis 25 relates that Esau sold his birthright to Jacob, and in Genesis 27 relates that the blessings became the possession of Jacob as well. And as a consequence, Esau sought to destroy Jacob. The struggle that began in Rebekah's womb continued in these two boys as they grew into manhood, and let me tell you something, endures to this very day in their descendants. Ezekiel 35:5 and Amos chapter 11 and verse 1 respectively speak, and this is from the New American Standards renderings, but Ezekiel 35:5 and Amos 1 and verse 11 respectively speak of an everlasting enmity and a fury forever persisting between these two peoples. An everlasting enmity and a fury forever persisting between these two people, between the Edomites and the Israelites. Now, as we examined, very briefly, but as we examined the scriptural traits of the Israelite, it is quite apparent that today's Celto-Saxons are today's Israelites. On the other hand, as documented by Charles Wiseman's book, Who is Esau? Edom, most of today's Jews are the racial descendants of the Edomite nation, which adopted the religion of Judaism in the 2nd century B.C. and later, 6th and 7th century A.D. as well at a later time. For example, under the heading Edom, in the Encyclopedia Judaica, volume 6, page 378, it states this, quote, in the days of John Hyrcanus, end of the 2nd century B.C.E., and a little later, the Edomites became a section of the Jewish people. Under the heading Edom, Edomian, the Jewish Encyclopedia, volume 5, page 41, it states, quote, they, speaking of the Edomites, were then incorporated with the Jewish nation. In other words, these Edomites became known as Jews within the Judahite nation. Under the heading Edom, Edomia, once again, in the New Standard Jewish Encyclopedia, on page 589, it says, quote, from then on they, speaking of the Edomites again, constituted a part of the Jewish or Judahite people. Herod, or what was known as the Judahite people, even though they were not. Going on, Herod, who was king of Judea, of course, at the time of Christ, being one of their descendants, end of quote. Maybe there is something much more genetically inherent of why King Herod, maybe it wasn't just a protection of the throne, that he went out and had all the babies between birth and 2 years old murdered. Maybe it was a genetic imprint because of the fact that he was an Edomite. And Flavius Josephus in the Antiquities of the Jews, book 13, chapter 11, and verse 1 stated, they, speaking of the Edomites, were hereafter no other than Jews. Obviously non-Israelite Jews, but known as Jews. People who called themselves Jews, but are not, but are of the synagogue of Satan. Possibly. Why not? Now, with all of this in mind, how much time did I have? 10 minutes? Okay. With all of this in mind, I want you to listen very closely to the testimony of a Jew by the name of Maurice Samuel, who in 1924 authored a book called You Gentiles. On pages 95 to 96, he wrote the following. We'll start with this. He said, quote, speaking of Christian Celto-Saxon, he says, your system of morality is no less a need to you than ours to us, that is, the Talmudic Jews. And the incompatibility of the two systems is not passive. You might say, well, let us exist side by side and tolerate each other, and that's normally our tendency. As wrong as it is, that's our tendency because we're a benevolent people. But he says, you might say, well, let us exist side by side and tolerate each other. We will not attack your morality, nor you ours. But, he says, the misfortune is that the two are not merely different. They are opposed in mortal, though tacit or unspoken, enmity. Enmity, everlasting enmity, it says in the prophets. And then he says, listen to this, no man can accept both, or accepting either, do otherwise than despise the other. Now think about what Maurice Samuel just said and ask yourself, what's that say about what's today known as Judeo Christianity. Let me tell you, if ever there was an oxymoron, that's it. Especially when you understand one's religious book of faith in contrast to the other's religious book of faith. In other words, the Bible in contrast to the Talmud and what it says about God and Christ and so many other things. Maury Samuel, in the very last statement of what I just quoted to you, said, "No man can accept both or accepting either do otherwise than despise the other." Doesn't that sound a whole lot like what Yahshua declared in Luke 16:13, where he says, "No servant can serve two masters, for either hate the one and love the other, or hold the one and despise the other." Let me tell you, those involved in Judeo-Christianity versus Christian Israel had better think very carefully about what they're involved in. Because Maurice Samuel and Christ both said, you can't serve both. You'll either hate the one and love the other, or else hold the one and despise the other. That's just the way it is. Maurice Samuel went on page 96 to say, "I believe that the preferences and the aversions which I here express will at least serve to make clear the irreconcilable differences between Jewish and Gentile morality." On page 154, he said, "The Jewish radical, and a little later, will discover that nothing can bridge the gulf between you and us." And then on pages 19 through 24, especially pertinent, he says, "There are two life forces in the world I know, Jewish and Gentile, ours and yours. If this be a truth, we must not be driven from it." Later he says, "Here is the Gentile life force, here is the Jewish life force. What their origin was, I cannot say." But Maurice Samuel may not have been able to say, but we can. One was Jacob Israel, one source, one life force was Jacob Israel's, and one life force was Esau Edom's. He goes on later, "I can only affirm to the Jews in the main belongs the Jewish life force, a consistent and coherent force, a direction in human thought and reaction. To you others belong the Gentile life force, a mode of life and thought distinct from ours." And then later again he says, "I do not believe that this primal or innate difference between Gentile and Jew is reconcilable. Later, with the best will on both sides, successful adaptation to each other will always be insecure and transient." And later again, "But as has come to pass so often, the difference which is deeper than will, deeper than consciousness, genetically imprinted, will assert itself. There is a limit to our moral or mental possibilities. We, speaking of the Jews, cannot climb out of ourselves the complete and permanent reconciliation of your, the Christian Celto-Saxon way, of life with ours is beyond that limit." End of that quote. These two life forces which Maurice Samuel seemed to wonder about are easily understood from a biblical perspective, especially when the players have been identified. Without recognizing it, Maurice Samuel was simply identifying what God prophesied several thousand years ago. That is the ongoing struggle between Esau, Edom, and Jacob, Israel. What we have today with the Jewish people trying to claim and convince the world that they're Israel is just the continuing struggle for Esau's descendants who are trying to reclaim the birthright and the blessing by any way, by hook or crook, that they can do so. It's the battle between the two. Now can you begin to see why earlier in this series I declared that what we have been discussing has national and international implications? You know, we haven't just been having a discussion about interesting, but nonetheless inconsequential Bible data. That's not what we've been doing here. What we have been and are discussing had and continues to have worldwide repercussions. We are suffering. We are going through war after war after war. We're very likely to get in another one. That's simply the repercussions of the false teaching and the false doctrines and the false understandings and perceptions about who is Esau Edom and who is Jacob Israel. In fact, ever since the pregnancy of Rebekah, everything that has happened and does happen on the world scene is interrelated or interconnected with the battle, the life and death struggle between Jacob Israel and Esau Edom. Taken, I wish I had time to just talk about so many others that fit into this whole thing, but so many people, it's just an event that's happened, a regrettable event that happened, but just as an example, take the recent U.S. Embassy bombings by bin Laden and his Arab buddies. Why has bin Laden declared war on America? You know, why would he want to do that? Well, by the testimony of his own mouth, he declared that it is because of America's backing of the Israelis. Or if you will, divide the term, what do you come up with? Because of Israel lies. The Israelis, or Israel lies, pronounced a little bit differently. The Arabs know that today's Ashkenazi Jews, or today's Israelis, are imposters and do not have the right to dispossess them of their land in the Middle East. Just one of so many things we could talk about. So many repercussions of people understanding this particular truth, being taught incorrectly and coming to the wrong or the totally opposite conclusions as what they biblically should. And now let me assure you, with all of that, with all that we've talked about, that this message, the Christian Israel message, the much maligned, and you'll probably figure out why now. I guarantee there's going to be some people real upset with this series because they can't dare to have this truth get out. The much maligned Christian identity message, which is interconnected and in no way can be separated from the death, burial, and resurrection of Yahweh Yeshua, is undeniably the most important message facing America. Now, without the death, burial, and resurrection, it wouldn't mean anything. So, but it's interconnected with that because that was our means of being remarried to God. It is the most important message, bar none, facing America and the rest of the world today, since, as goes true Israel, the apple of God's eye, Deuteronomy 32, 9 and 10, and Zechariah 2, 7 and 8, so goes, as goes true Israel, so goes the rest of the world. 2 Ezra 6, 8, and 9, on the birth of the twin boys, Esau and Jacob. Verse 8, and he said unto me, from Abraham unto Isaac, when Jacob and Esau were born of him, Jacob's hand held first the heel of Esau. Verse 9, for Esau is the end of the world, and Jacob is the beginning of it that followeth. Now I would say, that's a worldwide impact, wouldn't you? In Esau is the end, or might we say, the death of the world. And in Jacob is the beginning, or the life of the world. So let me encourage you, stay tuned for the continuing real life drama between Esau, Edom, and Jacob, Israel. Let's stand and we'll close in prayer.